It's Tuesday, March 14th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Victor Beatty, coming to you from Studio 22 in Washington. The war of words between Turkey and the Netherlands continues. Does it threaten the NATO alliance?
Robust debate is at the heart of our democracy, but so is also mutual respect.
Also ahead, Brexit clears its final domestic hurdle.
The ayes to the right, 335. The noes to the left, 287.
And millions along the U.S. Northeast brace for a late winter blizzard. Those stories and more on International Edition. Turkey vowed the Netherlands would pay for barring Turkish officials from rallies with Turkish expatriates. Ankara Monday said it would suspend high-level diplomatic relations with the Dutch. New sanctions include a ban on the Dutch ambassador and diplomatic flights from the Netherlands, although there don't appear any economic measures or travel restrictions on average Europeans. At issue is a Turkish referendum scheduled next month that will boost the powers of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who is seeking the support of Turks everywhere. Dutch and German officials barred Turkish officials from taking part in rallies, citing security concerns. We begin with reporter Dorian Jones in Istanbul.
Dutch envoy Daan Feddo Huizinga was summoned Monday by the Turkish foreign minister for the third time in as many days to receive a diplomatic dressing down. This latest verbal salvo reportedly was for the crackdown by Dutch police on ethnic Turks who demonstrated Saturday in Rotterdam over the removal of Turkish Family and Social Policies Minister Fatma Betül Sayınkaya from the Netherlands. Turkish pro-government newspapers Monday published photos of police dogs biting demonstrators, with one headline reading, "Nazi Dogs." Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has repeatedly called the Dutch government Nazis for preventing two of his ministers from speaking at a rally for ethnic Turks in support of an April referendum to extend presidential powers. Political columnist Semi Adiz of Al Monitor website says the dispute has reached unprecedented levels.
I think it is very serious because words and remarks have been exchanged that have never been exchanged before, and there was a Turkish demonstrators were attacked by police in the Netherlands. So I think that the government support base in Turkey will be clamoring for some kind of serious retaliation. So the prospects for the situation escalating rather than de-escalating are quite high at the moment.
Despite Erdogan dominating most of the media, substantial funds and his formidable campaign skills, opinion polls suggest he is struggling to win referendum support. Political consultant Attila Yeşilada of Global Source Partners says diplomatic tensions with Europe could be to Erdogan's advantage.
As it stands right now, my gut feeling tells me the no votes are ahead, or at least AKP doesn't have the kind of confidence it has in the past polls that it will win. So AKP wants to fortify the nationalist vote. You know, this kind of clashes, which are exaggerated by Mr. Erdogan's rhetoric, does reinforce the view that, you know, European powers are our enemies and that Mr. Erdogan is steadfastly fighting for our rights.
With other European countries too banning Turkish ministers from addressing referendum rallies, the prospect of the crisis deepening and spreading remains real. Some Turkish pro-government media have suggested the refugee deal between Ankara and the European Union that has stemmed the flood of people into Europe could be in jeopardy over the crisis. Analysts suggest Ankara would be reluctant to take such a step, with the refugee deal being one of the few remaining ties that underpins its relations with Europe, as well as being an important piece of leverage. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
European Union Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini and Enlargement Commissioner Johannes Hahn have called on Turkey to refrain from excessive statements and actions that risk further exacerbating the situation. NATO Chief Jens Stoltenberg urged Turkey and its NATO allies to show mutual respect, be calm, and have a measured approach to contribute to de-escalate tensions.
Robust debate is at the heart of our democracy, but so is also mutual respect. And therefore, I will encourage all allies to show mutual respect, to be calm and have a measured approach, to contribute to de-escalate the tensions and diffuse tensions and de-escalate the situation. I think it's important that we now focus on everything that unites us, the common challenges, the threats, and how NATO is adapting, and that we not focus on issues that occasionally divides us.
Joe Burton is a senior lecturer in international security at the University of Waikato in New Zealand. He follows developments involving NATO closely. He told me domestic politics appears to be fueling the current tensions. He doesn't expect any lasting damage to the alliance.
Things are particularly inflamed at the moment because of the elections. I would say probably the pattern is for these crises to dissipate reasonably quickly, and that probably business as normal will return after the referendums are out of the way.
Are you concerned about the direction that Turkey's politics is going?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think for NATO particularly, NATO has always been fundamentally a community of democracies, and the direction that Turkey is taking under Erdogan really is the wrong direction. We've seen, for example, the country jailing more journalists than any other country in 2016. You've had media outlets closed, more than 40,000 people arrested, 100,000 workers dismissed from public office. So I think we've seen a real consolidation of power in Turkey under Erdogan since the coup last year. And as a community of democracies, this is a deeply troubling trend for NATO. And it's not just happening in Turkey, by the way. We've had populist movements growing in other NATO countries. In the UK, we've had Brexit, obviously. We're concerned about the National Front's possible success in the French elections. The far-right party, the Freedom Party in Netherlands, is set to poll very well in the election there. And as a community of democracies, NATO does need to be very concerned about this.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg called on both Turkey and the Netherlands to defuse the row. How might this impact NATO operations?
Well, I think NATO operations are, for the most part at the moment, really focused on NATO's eastern flank and the tensions with Russia. I think NATO's primary raison d'etre at the moment is bolstering deterrence due to Russian aggression in Ukraine and concerns that Russia might take similar action, for example, in the Baltic states. So that's where its real operational focus is at the moment. NATO isn't a part formally of the coalition against ISIS, but Turkey is, of course, a very key player in the campaign against ISIS. And Turkey has been, if you like, that bridge between Europe and the Middle East for NATO ever since Turkey joined the alliance.
Joe Burton said he doesn't expect Turkey to withdraw from NATO. He said Ankara benefits from having access to the Western security community. This is the Voice of America.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listener's mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on the Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Here are some of the stories making headlines. Turkey sanctions Dutch diplomats as tensions rise among NATO members. Britain clears the final domestic hurdle and heads to Brexit negotiations with the EU. Congressional analysis concludes the Republican health care plan will leave millions without coverage. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on VOANews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The House of Commons Monday handed British Prime Minister Theresa May a victory, passing legislation giving her the power to start the process of exiting the European Union that voters demanded in last June's referendum. The lower house threw out amendments tacked on earlier by the House of Lords. Brexit Secretary David Davis addressed Parliament after the vote and tried to ease concerns of lawmakers that prompted the amendments in the House of Lords.
Over the last 5 weeks, we have seen Parliament at its best. Honourable and right honourable members and peers have spoken with passion, sincerity and conviction. However, I was disappointed that the House of Lords voted to amend this bill. This bill is just the next step in a long democratic process surrounding our exit from the European Union. On the forthcoming negotiations, our guiding approach is simple. We will not do anything which will undermine the national interest, including the interests of British citizens living in the European Union, and we will not enter the negotiations with our hands tied. This is not to say I do not appreciate the concerns that lie behind these amendments. It's not the ends we disagree on, but the means.
The measure now goes to the Queen for her symbolic approval, and that the process of negotiating a historic exit after more than 40 years in the EU can begin. Anne-Marie Elijah has been watching the Brexit process from her vantage point at the Australian National University's Centre for European Studies.
And so what we've seen in the past couple of weeks is some parliamentary ping-pong, as they call it, between the Lords and the Commons, and eventually the outcome that a lot of analysts had predicted, which was that it would go through without amendments. So now what we see is the kind of formal beginning, if you like, of the actual Brexit process. And I guess in some ways this is where we move from a kind of theoretical proposition to something that's actually deeply practical, and that is the beginning of the negotiations once Article 50 is triggered.
Well, the House of Lords was concerned about guaranteeing the rights of EU nationals living in Britain and giving lawmakers more power to reject the final terms of the deal reached with the EU.
Exactly, and those two amendments were, in the end, both then voted down by the Lords once they realised that it would not, in fact, pass the Commons with the amendments. But those two issues remain an ongoing concern. Now the question becomes, at the end of this long period of negotiation that we will see once Article 50 is triggered, how much of a role does Parliament have in the final text or the final agreement between the UK and the EU27, and of course, for the purposes of those EU nationals over whom people are arguing, what is going to happen to those people and when will we know the outcome for them? But these, of course, are just two issues in a whole suite of things that have to be sorted out in the course of negotiations.
Does the EU have to pass its own legislation saying that the two-year period of Brexit has begun?
Council President Donald Tusk has already indicated that the EU will respond quite quickly once the UK government formally triggers Article 50. And most people think that the process from here on in will involve a formal convening of the European Council once more in order to set forward with a negotiating mandate and so on. But it does depend a little bit on Prime Minister May's timing, because there is already an informal council, a non-summit, if you like, of the EU27 scheduled for the very end of March, the 25th in fact, and that signals the end of a process that's called the Bratislava process, whereby the 27 are thinking about the future of the European Union in relation to Brexit and indeed a suite of other challenges.
One challenge the Prime Minister faces is Scotland and its threat to hold a second independence referendum as early as next year. Anne-Marie Elijah said the threat is real, but so are the obstacles facing Scotland, including borders, EU membership, and independence from the United Kingdom. Scottish voters turned down an independence referendum in 2014. This is The Voice of America.
This is Science in a Minute.
When we see someone yawn or scratch an itch, sometimes we can't help but respond in kind. For many years, many scientists have thought that this behavior was an empathic or psychological response. A new study by researchers at the Washington University School of Medicine proposes that the mimic scratching response is controlled by chemicals released in the brain. In the study, researchers showed mice videos of other mice scratching themselves. The scientists noticed that the videos evoked a similar behavior in the live mice. The scientists then found that whenever a mouse saw another one scratch, a chemical called GRP would be released by a part of its brain that controls wake-sleep functions. When the researchers blocked the GRP in the mouse brain, they found that mice would no longer mimic scratching behavior as observed in video. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Here now in the U.S., the healthcare debate over repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, took a new turn Monday when the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office announced the Republican proposal to replace it will result in 14 million fewer Americans having health insurance. It said by 2026 that number could swell to 24 million. Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price called the CBO assessment simply wrong, saying it failed to take into account subsequent legislation and regulatory changes that are planned.
The CBO looked at a portion of our plan, but not the entire plan. In fact, the entire plan includes the regulatory apparatus that we've got the ability to use at Health and Human Services that the previous administration used significantly, but we want to use it to make certain that patients are helped and that costs are decreased. They also ignored completely the other legislative activities that we'll be putting into place that will make certain that we have an insurance market that actually works. So we disagree strenuously with the report that was put out. We believe that our plan will cover more individuals at a lower cost and give them the choices that they want for the coverage that they want for themselves and for their family, not that the government forces them to buy.
The CBO did say the Republican plan reduces the budget deficit and it would also, over time, reduce health care premiums. But opposition Democrats like House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi pounced on the CBO report.
The accounting is in. The CBO has reported that the Republican bill pushes 24 million people out of health care, off of health coverage. This is a remarkable figure. It speaks so eloquently to the cruelty of the bill that the Speaker calls an act of mercy.
The Republican measure, known as the American Health Care Act, is working its way through congressional committees, with some analysts suggesting the CBO report Monday could increase opposition to it. This is The Voice of America. A late winter storm is descending in the U.S. Northeast, affecting some 50 million people from Washington, D.C. northward up to Boston and further inland. Blizzard conditions are taking hold in some parts, with snow accumulations expected to reach 60 centimeters in some spots. High winds are expected to cause blowing and drifting snow, reducing visibility. Thousands of flights have already been canceled. German Chancellor Angela Merkel's planned meeting Tuesday with President Donald Trump in Washington was pushed back to Friday. I spoke with AccuWeather meteorologist Brian Edwards.
This is going to be extremely widespread in terms of we're going to be looking at snowfall amounts 30 to 60 centimeters from all the way from the eastern third of Pennsylvania, northern New Jersey, New York City, all the way up into most of central and northern New England. So you're talking at least eight states being affected by snowfall amounts in that range. And certainly in some of the higher elevations of northeast Pennsylvania and the Catskills in New York, there could be local amounts up to 90 centimeters of snow, the bulk of that falling Tuesday into Tuesday night. So a very short duration storm, but some very intense snowfall rates.
Well, what is the term blizzard? What does it mean?
Generally, a blizzard means that you can actually have a blizzard with very light snow, but the blizzard part of it means that you have to have sustained winds of 55 kilometers per hour or greater for a period of 3 hours. So it doesn't matter how intense the snow is, but it's how intense the wind is. And because we're going to have those 50 to 60 kilometer per hour winds along much of coastal New England while it's snowing very heavily, it's going to create visibilities near zero and whiteout conditions. But that's the technical definition of blizzard.
Aside from the winds, the rates of snowfall are going to be quite intense for a period of time.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, we're looking at snowfall rates anywhere from 3 to 8 centimeters per hour. And not only that, but you could see in some of those most intense bands where it's coming down at up to 8 centimeters an hour, you can see some thunder and lightning as well. That's how intense this storm system is going to be, especially very late tonight and into the daytime hours on Tuesday when those heavier snow bands are affecting southern New England and parts of the Mid-Atlantic.
Well, the storm comes at the end of what had been an unusually warm and dry winter for the Northeast, creating drought conditions in some places. Brian Edwards said this storm will help ease those dry conditions. This is VOA's International Edition. Well, this month marks a notorious anniversary for the rap music world, as VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald and VOA's Jim Stevenson discuss a big murder mystery.
That's cargo, my cargo, 160, swiftly, wreck it by a new one, the crew run, 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 the crew run, run.
It's a tragic anniversary, the 20th anniversary of a murder that is still talked about to this day. On March 9th, 1997, Christopher Wallace, a rapper known as Biggie Smalls or the Notorious B.I.G., was fatally shot after leaving a Vibe magazine party at the Peterson Automotive Museum in Los Angeles. That murder remains unsolved, and it came 6 months after the similar shooting death of fellow superstar rapper Tupac Shakur in Las Vegas, and that murder also remains unsolved. And both of these killings have given rise to many conspiracy theories because people just aren't talking. One theory says that now imprisoned Death Row Records founder Marion Suge Knight ordered Wallace's death in retaliation for Tupac's murder, which was orchestrated by Sean Puffy Combs, who was the head of Wallace's label, Bad Boy Records. Now, Combs has always maintained he had nothing to do with the murder. This was a bi-coastal feud between rappers from New York and the West Coast, notably Los Angeles. It just sort of built on itself. It was like a gangster movie that got out of hand, and a lot of inflammatory lyrics and back and forth. And it ended in these two tragic murders. The Los Angeles Times a few years ago ran a series reporting that the Crips had killed Shakur in a hit orchestrated by Christopher Wallace. Suge Knight had ties to the Crips' rivals, the Bloods, so the gangs were supposedly involved in this. And the investigation also reached into the Los Angeles Police Department, with allegations that more than 70 officers in the anti-gang divisions were guilty of crimes including shootings, beatings, and planting evidence. So as the investigations broadened, they just grew more and more all-encompassing, which gave rise to even more conspiracy theories that maybe this was just the tip of a very corrupt iceberg. Making the whole thing more difficult were the relationships between the rap community and law enforcement. There has always been mistrust, which continues to this day. So there weren't a lot of witnesses. There weren't a lot of people talking. And so you had this veil of secrecy.
A defining moment in the history of rap music, and certainly what has followed since.
The deadliness seemed to sort of dissipate after these two murders. I think it shocked everyone so much. The murders have inspired books and movies. An upcoming TV series called Unsolved is coming from Anthony Hemingway. So these murders, which may never be solved, still continue to dominate the public's imagination. Notorious B.I.G. died 20 years ago, March 9th, 1997.
While people aren't talking about these unsolved murders, we talk all the time. Ray McDonald presents the Top 20 Countdown each and every week on VOA 1.
And you can also catch my Twitter feed at Ray on the Hits.
Thanks so much, Ray.
You got it, Jim.
Biggie, 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 can't you see? Sometimes your words just hypnotize me. And I just love your flashy ways. Guess that's why they're broken, you're so
And you've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Like us on Facebook, VOA Now. Follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us. I thank my director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall. I'm Victor Beatty in Washington. You're listening to The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In a world where national security is increasingly dependent on close cooperation with like-minded governments, the United States is working with longtime partners and forming new and innovative partnerships to advance our mutual security goals. The U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Political and Military Affairs links together the U.S. Departments of State and Defense, the Congress, and the U.S. defense industry in a combined effort to help improve the security capabilities of our allies around the world. We do this by providing them with the tools and training necessary to effectively respond to even the most dire of security challenges. We work worldwide, helping Iraq and our coalition partners to make gains against ISIS, supporting nations across Southeast Asia to safeguard their territorial waters, and standing with our partners across Africa against terrorists like Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab, among other challenges. David McKeeby, public affairs officer at the Bureau of Political Military Affairs, wrote in a recent blog post. To help achieve this goal, the Bureau of Political Military Affairs oversees some $6 billion in security assistance programs that are meant to help our partners invest in U.S. training and in U.S. manufactured equipment. At the same time, the Foreign Military Sales System, a foreign policy tool that acts as a form of security assistance, allows the United States to transfer defense equipment and services to our partners worldwide. Any such transfer first goes through a sensitive vetting process because before a sale is approved, the U.S. government must carefully weigh a wide range of factors to ensure that such transfers of often sophisticated, top-of-the-line U.S. military equipment are consistent with U.S. foreign policy. Finally, the Lead Nation Procurement Initiative allows our NATO allies to transfer to other NATO members military equipment purchased from the United States. Thus, the United States and its allies can maintain flexibility, keep down costs, yet still retain the ability to keep track of the equipment. While we may not know what next major international security challenge may emerge, wrote Public Affairs Officer David McKeeby, you can count on the United States' continued commitment to taking action, strengthening our allies and partners, and safeguarding America.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.